Want to hone your craft as a digital marketer and get expert insights from thought leaders and industry experts? Welcome to the How I Work podcast. I'm your host, Josh Becerra, founder and president of Agurian. Follow us on Twitter at Agurian Tweets or subscribe to our YouTube channel for more great content. Now, here's the episode of the podcast. Hi, everybody. This is Josh Becerra from Agurian. This is episode 23 of How I Work. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming Andrew Davies. Andrew has over 20 plus years of experience working in startups, both as a founder and an executive. He's done everything from bootstrapping startups to raising $200 million at a $1.4 billion valuation in Series D. So that's amazing. Currently, Andrew's the CMO of Paddle, a payments infrastructure platform for high-growth SaaS companies, serving over 3,000 customers. Andrew also advises SaaS scale-ups and sits on a board of 90, an agile digital transformation consultancy, serving the insurance industry and giving 90% of its distributable profits to alleviate global poverty. Andrew, that's pretty awesome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, total pleasure, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So this idea of being in startups that were both bootstrapped all the way to where you're got a unicorn over $1 billion valuation, that's quite a wide variety of experiences. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got into software as a service and a little bit of that story?
Sure thing. And as we were just talking about before we started recording, these journeys make much more sense in hindsight than they do on the journey. Yeah, and right. as you're pathing that route, and there was certainly not much of a plan behind it. This is one of those cases. I think Winston Churchill is quoted as saying that success is lurching from one failure to the next with no loss of enthusiasm. And also it looks good from retrospect, and I'm very happy where I am now. But there's been lots of failures and lurching from one to the other along the way.
That sounds very familiar.
My entrepreneurial journey started... It does for all of us. It does for all of us, yeah, except those who are on TechCrunch or the front of Wired magazines. For them, it's all perfect.
Yeah, right.
we started the first business at university. I had the privilege of being a scholar with Deloitte Consulting before university. So they have this scholarship program. They take you and fund your university degree, and you work for them during the holidays. You do a year's worth of work before then.
Sure.
And I loved it. I've got friends back from that day 20 years ago. I enjoyed my time with them. I was in Strat Consulting and audit for technology, media, and telecoms companies. But my dad's an accountant. It just felt like a very obvious career path and one that would be a bit restrictive. And I went to university after that year of experience with one goal, which was to start a business so that I could say no to my Deloitte offer when I finished my graduation.
Don't become an accountant.
And so university was, misplaced confidence of youth. So university was kind of trying to start things whilst doing my degree. We started a top-end women's wear fashion label that ended up in court in our second year. We started a translation business, a web business, and we ended up kind of finishing and graduating with a social media analytics firm. And this was in the early days of the Twitter API, and we were building Twitter apps and Facebook apps for large corporations in the UK. And as we left university, that was sustainable enough to be a very small starter job for me and my co-founder. But at the same time, I'd met the co-founder of my first SaaS business in my final year, and he was doing something that felt it had a lot more lift in it, a lot more growth potential in it, in the personalization space. And so I started that with him. We bumbled along for a bunch of years. It ended up being a leading B2B personalization engine called Ideo. We were powering the content personalization for Salesforce, IBM, SAP, a whole bunch of other companies on exit. We sold that in December 2019 and became part of a roll-up backed by a private equity firm called Insight Venture Partners. And so we were the first of five acquisitions. We were sell side once and then buy side four or five times. And I ran global marketing there. So I was co-founder and CMO of our business, then ran global marketing for this larger software company that was kind of 1,300 people. And during that journey, I also was advising 15 or 16 SaaS businesses through that couple of years on their growth, their ABM demand gen, you know, messaging, positioning, fundraising. And I love that. And actually Paddle was one of those. And I, you know, they're actually funded by the same VC that backed my business IDEO. So I knew a few of the people there, jumped in to have a look and help them out with a few things, fell in love with the business. And so joined Paddle at the beginning of 2022, where I am CMO. And as you said, we've raised a bunch of money in our Series D. We've made a big acquisition a few months ago. And I'm pumped to be here as we try and put a dent into the payments infrastructure business.
I mean, it's an amazing story. And like you said, looking back now, it all seems to fit and be perfect. And I'm sure your dad is very happy that you didn't become an accountant and just take that Deloitte offer in the end.
Just about. I think it's taken him until very recently to feel that way.
That's great. So, you know, one of the things that I read in your bio and we talked a little bit about is that you really, because of this experience, have had a lot of time leading marketing teams, right? And so I'd like to just dive into the topic of marketing teams. It's something that really interests me. And so when you think about marketing teams, what attributes do you see as like the signals for great teams and how they function? Or conversely, like what are some of the signs of dysfunction that you found in your work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, firstly, I guess let's strip away the word marketing, because, you know, these things I think are true of any team. I'm a fan of, you know, Patrick Lencioni and the Table Group and some of their methodology. You might well have come across it. And have used that in multiple businesses. And for those who haven't, you know, if you just Google five dysfunctions of a team, you'll see some good graphics and explainers there. But, you know, his research and his practices research talks about how you need trust, and on trust you can build, you know, the ability to have conflict rather than artificial harmony and a fear of conflict. And on that you can build commitment, which is not ambiguous. And on top of that, you hold people to account and you have high standards. And on top of that you have results without care for status or ego. And I think, you know, that's kind of how I see the world, in that it all starts with trust, and it all starts with, do we trust each other to have hard conversations, to have difficult conversations? Do we trust each other to give feedback to ourselves? Yeah. Do we invite that because we've got those relationships? And so, you know, in terms of signs of teams that feel great or don't feel great, or are acting in a high performance way versus being dysfunctional, I think that the ability to ask questions openly and challenge with empathy are great signs of a high performing team. You know, I love it when I find ideas that sprout and get nurtured and finessed without me knowing anything about them, without any top down input. You know, finding stuff that's going on that I didn't initiate, that's still driving towards the goals of the organization. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side, you know, people leaving suddenly without a conversation as to why. Silence in big team meetings, the lack of any fun, the absence of being able to hold people to account. And fundamentally, and I guess the phrase I use for this is I love to be in a place where we can teach the wider team the rules of the game so they can go and play it themselves, yeah, rather than be in a situation where everything has to come top down. And, you know, part of my university, Josh, I was at university for first and third year in the UK, and in the US at the University of Richmond in Virginia for my second year. Okay. And I'm going to make a very bad comparison here, and you'll hate me for it if you're a US sports fan. But, you know, soccer, out the proper football that we play over this side
football,
of the pond.
Yeah.
Very creative, right? You have positions, but there's no set plays, or very few set plays. It's made up in the moment. And when I came to the US and I found, you know, American football, where, you know, the rule book is this thick and the playbook is this thick. And, you know, if I know as a running back, I can run 150 yards this way and turn 90 degrees and run 30 yards this way, put my hands up and the ball will fall into my hands, and I know I've done a good job. And I guess, you know, not to diss on American football, but I love the ability to teach people the wider rules of the game and allow them to be creative within it, mm-hmm, rather than everything being run as a play from the top.
Yeah. We won't hold your diss on American football against you. It's just fine. And I will say, I do love the comparison. I am also a soccer fan, and I played football in my early days. We won't get into that today, but I do agree with you that there is like a different level of liberty. And I love what you're saying about, you know, helping people just understand the rules and then go out and play and be creative. And I also love Patrick Lencioni. If I was in my home office, you'd see that Five Dysfunctions of a Team book sitting on the shelf right behind me. But today I'm at the office recording. Well, I think that's really true. I think that some of the struggles that I've seen with CMOs or just within organizations in general is that you as the CMO might be able to develop that team and give them that level of creativity and be able to foster kind of what all that you're talking about. It's kind of going the opposite direction, right? Your role within the C-suite, I see a lot of CMOs who, you know, there's CFOs sitting in the room, and everybody, of course, has an opinion about marketing, even though they aren't trained. And so do you have any words of advice for CMOs on, like, how do you get that other team, that first team, that team in that C-suite to really, like, respect your area of expertise? Kind of how do you own that? How do you get people to understand that you're not going to be commenting on the chart of accounts and how it should be, you know, managed or not? And so, you know, any advice about kind of the other team, that first team, which would be in the C-suite?
Yeah, I think firstly, if you have the privilege and the opportunity, choosing a team where you know that is valued to start with, I think, is the first step. I think there are a lot of people who take on positions, and that is an element of the validation or an element of the job search they haven't fully gone through, or haven't been allowed to go through. And I was very privileged in this role at Paddle to have met everybody through that advisory work before I was offered a job. Yeah. And it was a bit of an odd interview process where there wasn't really an interview process because I'd already been, you know, doing some work and helping them a little bit. And so I think firstly, yeah, it's pick a team where that counts. How, you know, the chief storyteller is usually the CEO, not the CMO. Right. And so do you have a CEO who wants that, who has that, has a clear understanding of what that is, has a clear understanding of marketing? Do you have a CFO who, you know, has been in high growth environments where you do need to spend to get to where you want to go and has an understanding of what those norm and benchmarks are within the industry? So I think choosing the right team is first there. I think a couple of other things that I've, you know, found important is there's a challenge of different functions using completely different languages. We find it in the sales and marketing divide, with sales, you know, talking about opportunities and individuals, and marketing talking about, you know, click-through rates and audiences. But we also see it across function in the leadership team, whether it's finance, whether it's the people team or other elements of that leadership. And I think learning other people's language, and so you're able to help translate, is really, really important. If I can, you know, talk about customer acquisition cost and what that's going to do in our lifetime value, and think about profitability and not just about revenue, then certainly I'm going to have a better and a more interesting conversation with my CFO. And then the second piece of it, other than language, is that bit about benchmarking. I think as the SaaS industry grows up and matures, there is a much better set of benchmarks over what is normal to spend in different environments. And I've got my own kind of rules of thumb over what you might need to spend in different environments, but introducing people to external data sets of what is normal is usually very, very helpful in that environment too.
Yeah, I love that. I really do. So, you know, one of the things that I think ties into this kind of philosophy and team is around, and you mentioned it in the pyramid, like this, the level, which is around accountability, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've been talking about more and more is how I believe marketing organizations need to really characterize themselves more as learning organizations than like strictly kind of KPI chasing environments, right? I feel like when I see organizations that are just solely focused on like, did we hit our KPIs or did we not, you're kind of find yourself in an environment of constant judgment, right? And anytime teams or people, individuals, humans are feeling like they're constantly being judged, it doesn't work to the benefit of the company. You know, it's like your the decision-making process, executive functions are kind of shut down because you're just like, oh my gosh, I'm being judged all the time. And so I'd be curious to hear your take on like this idea of experimentation and learning being really the where marketing teams need to be, like the relationship that they need to be having with their data is really around learning versus just like hitting all the KPIs. And I'm not saying that KPIs aren't important and that we don't want to try to hit them, but you know, there is data in failure. And there, like when you fail, you can learn a lot from, like, why did that tactic not work? What are our competitors doing differently? So can you talk a little bit about your personal philosophy around learning, like building a learning organization versus strictly chasing KPIs?
Yeah, of course. So I think you're making a great point there. And you know, most of us are operating in an environment where the only constant is change. And therefore, if we're not building a learning organization, you know, everything we're working on, those KPIs are likely to be missed in the future. In fact, I'd reframe the entire question and conversation in that it can all be KPI driven, but if we're entirely focused on short-term KPIs, we're never going to hit those long-term KPIs. And building a learning organization, a learning culture, experimenting is all about opening up the potential of hitting future KPIs. Right. And often we find organizations engaged in very short-term behavior and very short-termist KPIs. Mm-hmm. You know, we're having this conversation internally at Paddle right now. You know, there's a huge amount of focus on pipeline generation, opportunity creation, opportunity to close conversion rates and close to live conversion rates, all exceptionally important.
Sure.
But if we're also not talking a bit up the funnel, then actually, you know, next quarter, the future quarters are going to have much more challenge of reaching those ever-increasing goals. And I see it as a job of a CMO, as a job of a leader in marketing, is to hold two timeframes in mind at all points of time. So in everything I'm doing, I need to be focused on next quarter's demand gen to make sure the sales team are able to hit their targets, and 2 years out, position and description and category and what the audience can look like, such that there's a market size and addressable serviceable market we can go and win to hit the future goals there. And so I think the experimentation and the learning plays into both of those as well. You know, we have to be learning in our tactics right now, as well as in learning and experimenting about where we go. But yeah, wholeheartedly agree that, you know, I think, you know, maybe controversially, I think some of the short-term duration of many senior leaders in marketing does come down to the necessity of focusing on that short-term metric, either within themselves or imposed on themselves, which mean that further, you know, longer-term thinking and longer-term experimentation aren't able to happen. Yeah. And I'm very grateful to be in a place where, yes, I need to judge both of those and balance both of those, but there's space, and I'm afforded space, and I'm affording space to my team to be thinking beyond where they are right now in terms of their experiments.
Well, and I just think that, you know, what is working today might be tactics and strategies that we didn't even use a year ago. And what is working today is not what necessarily will be working tomorrow. And so I do think that, you know, organizations that can understand that there are, that this is moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. And the only way to really ensure that future is by staying ahead and having a willingness to put some budget behind things that might inevitably fail, but that we learn from those things.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, if we, you know, let's use a recent example from Paddle here, you know, we've produced eBooks, we've produced reports, we've done the normal type of stuff. When it came to the acquisition, we cut a behind the scenes documentary about the acquisition story. Mm-hmm. So we've got a full, you know, documentary, 25-minute documentary, you know, all of our scars, blood, toil, tears, sweat on show about how we did that acquisition. Now, that was a massive risk. It could have been rubbish. We could have not published it. We could have published it and it came really badly in terms of how it reflected on us or the process. You know, practically, it didn't cost much more than a good ebook or a couple of ebooks, mm-hmm. but it was a very different experiment. And for me, you know, there is that kind of truism that if we keep doing what we've always done, we're going to get what we've always got. Except that in marketing, where everyone else is raising the game, usually those returns are going to slip time after time. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm really trying to instill and hold true in the market we're in the company I'm in is that we really do have to give value to stand out. We have to build reciprocity. And I'm really interested in doing stuff that almost gets a WTF response, a kind of what on earth is going on here response from our audience, because we're doing things that are different to what they've seen before, but are still resonating.
Yeah, I think it's great. And the way that I feel that ties into like what we were talking about previously, which is like, you know, that number one team, your first team, like the CEO needs to get that and needs to like understand that, hey, we are going to be learning. We are going to be experimenting. We're going to be out there doing things that maybe our prospects will find intriguing and interesting, but we don't know if it will fall flat on its face. And there has to be alignment at that level. Otherwise, you know, CMOs have a really short lifetime. The average amount of time CMOs spend in their jobs is much shorter than other members of the C-suite. And I think that's why. It's because that lack of kind of alignment there.
Yeah. And you know, if we go all the way back up to, you know, five dysfunctions of a team, we said that foundation was trust. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where it all starts. I think trust gives you the ability to have experiments and to do things that are a bit off-piste. A wise colleague once said to me, and I've held this and used this phrase multiple times in multiple companies over the years, that whenever there's a gap in expectations, you've got the choice to fill it with trust or with suspicion. And building an organization and a culture at that C-suite, but also in your wider marketing team, where, you know, misunderstandings of expectation are filled with trust rather than with suspicion, is a key way of making sure you continually to pay it forwards to win the right to have more experiments in the future.
Yeah, man, that is great. I'm going to have to use that idea of, filling with either trust or suspicion. It happens all the time in our work. It's dead on. So, wow, this has been a great conversation. You know, one thing that I always ask my guests is kind of a last question is, who are you reading? What thought leadership is out there that's kind of impacting you or influencing you today? You mentioned, of course, Patrick Lencioni, but are there any others that this audience would be interested in?
Yeah, hey, I did my research beforehand and knew you'd be asking this, so I pulled a few books off my shelf. So Josh, I mean, you know, when it comes to, you know, before we get onto some books from other people, we do loads of our own shows ourselves. Okay. We've got a new season out of Protect the Hustle, which is a fantastic kind of interview-based show for SaaS leaders, which, you know, I'm not involved in producing, the team do it, and I love it when those episodes drop. It's one of the first things that I listen to. I listened to before we acquired it, and I love listening to it now. In terms of books, I pulled four that are different that I've read recently, that a couple of them I reread recently. An easy one, Bad Blood. The inside story of a very interesting tale at Theranos. You might well have known it or listened to the podcast or read the book.
Okay.
Those kind of inside stories of things that went wrong, or the startup journeys, massive scandal that's ended up in the courts, but, you know, fascinating book. I really enjoyed Trillion Dollar Coach. This is a book by, it's co-authored by Eric Schmidt, who was the CEO of Google and Alphabet. And it's talking about the coach that coached all of them, Bill. And he's really... Bill Campbell, he was a kind of a mentor for many Silicon Valley leaders. And I love the kind of the generosity that's in this book of how he helped many people, and they're helping other people too. And I've just dipped back into Play Bigger, which is a kind of a classic of the last couple of years in terms of building category strategy and how to dominate a market. And we're using a few frameworks from that in work right now. So there's three quick examples of things that I've read recently that and would fully recommend for those that are listening.
I love that. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time, Andrew. This has been a fabulous conversation. We're going to wrap it up here for our this episode of How I Work. But thanks so much.
Total pleasure. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the How I Work podcast with Josh Becerra. If you like what you heard, make sure you subscribe. To learn more about Agurian and for more digital marketing tips and insights, head to agurian.com.